Okay, my name is Francina Turner, and I am conducting an oral history interview with Rockmond Culver for the Reparative Histories and the Black Experience at UMD Oral History Project. So, Mr. Culver, let's begin with some background information. What's your hometown?
So my hometown, I would say, is Tacoma Park, Maryland. So I grew up for most of my childhood years there, although I was born in Washington, D.C.
Okay, and your birthday?
Birthday, September 13th, 1978.
Okay. How would you describe your life prior to enrolling at UMD in terms of your family composition, your home community, you know, their thoughts on education, that kind of thing?
Sure. So I guess I would describe my experience as, you know, a well-exposed one, meaning that my family, you know, they're on my father's side, they're Washingtonians for the most part. You know, my father grew up most of his years in Washington, D.C. My grandmother, spent a lot of her adult years in D.C. She was born in New York, spent some time in Virginia. So my point is, you know, we've been in and of the Washington, D.C. area for the most part. For all of our, you know, formative years. So with that, being in D.C., it's always been kind of a cosmopolitan area. Obviously, it's right by the city government. So, you know, my childhood was spent kind of having this dual consciousness of not only being someone who came up locally as a person in a relatively culturally and ethnically diverse area, but also kind of growing up in an area that, you know, is the seat of power for the entire country. And of course is pivotal on an international stage. So it was very interesting to kind of grow up with that dynamic. So, and with that, of course, you know, Washington, D.C., as it's, you know, adjacent to Virginia and Maryland, we don't talk about it as such here so much, but it is the South. Washington, D.C. was segregated. So my family's stories are very well, you know, kind of seeded with that kind of those narratives. What it was like to work in segregated D.C. What was it like to be the first family to integrate my father's neighborhood, for instance? You know, they lived on 16th and Upshur for many years. And prior to them moving in, there were no Black families in that community. So so a lot of my consciousness, you know, was shaped by those stories about what it was like to grow up as a Black family in this area. Mm-hmm. Like I said, even though it's seen as this, again, progressive cosmopolitan area, but still, like I said, subject to a lot of those forces due to segregation and racism and prejudice and so on. So so it just gave me that kind of lens, you know, as I grew up. And like I said, I went to school in Montgomery County, which again, comparatively speaking to a lot of areas around the country, it's one of the more diverse areas, you know, and the nation. So I was able to kind of get a sense for what it's like to engage with folks who come from a different background, different, you know, the different belief systems, different origins, and that was normalized for me, you know, even from a young age. So I would say by the time I got to, you know, high school age and ready to go off to college, I wanted to go somewhere that had a similar environment, similar dynamics, similar, you know, kind of cultural feel to it. So University of Maryland was a good fit, obviously, because it's right here in the heart of Prince George's County. Again, it's the seat of some of the greatest Black wealth in the country. Again, we don't talk about that enough, but you know, it was nice to go to University of Maryland and come across, again, University of Maryland is diverse. Even though the representation of, you know, BIPOC or people of color is not that great by the numbers, the way that I've always tried to explain it to our children, for instance, is, you know, the representation of Black folks may only be you know, it's traditionally over the years, it's hovered around 10%, you know, 10 mm-hmm. to 12, somewhere about that. So, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot. You know, we as our demographic share of the country is higher than that. But if we're talking about a massive institution, mm-hmm. we're talking about tens of thousands of students, 10% of that's still a lot of Black bodies. So it was nice to go to an institution where, you know, there are a lot of people there, but you still could find a niche for, you know, Black community and Black interaction. And there's a space for that alongside of, you know, our Latinx folks, our Asian folks, and so on. So, you know, I arrived at Maryland, you know, as kind of being the sum of, like I said, these experiences to that point where I did have exposure to different folks. I you know, I'd been used to dealing with some of the ignorance that comes with, you know, some of our white brethren who are not as exposed, not as used to coming up around different folks. So it wasn't like I arrived at Maryland and, you know, I started getting these weird comments or we call them microaggressions now. You know, it wasn't as if I was shocked. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. So said such and such. I'm like, nah, you know, all right, we've had some experience with this. And you know, it doesn't make it any less marginalizing. But I felt like I was at least equipped to try to find my path and to be able to navigate that and get what I needed or what I wanted at a university, despite, mm-hmm. like I said, some of those undercurrents. So long way to answer your question, but yeah, I would say that's a good
snapshot. So can you tell me a little bit about your parent or your parents' background?
Sure.
And was it, in your family, was it a foregone conclusion that you would attend college, or were you first gen, kind of that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you did ask about feelings about education, so pardon me. The The short answer is yes. It was a foregone conclusion that education was a way forward for us. You know, not only we as their children, but as Black folks in general. I was mm-hmm. particularly, I mentioned my paternal grandmother. She was very trailblazing even for her time as far as holding up education, formal education, as a way forward, even for Black women. So mm-hmm. she, you know, went to a variety of, you know, trade schools, was very adamant about kind of belonging to professional organizations. She was a member of Top Ladies of Distinction for many years, which was, you know, it's like I would say sorority adjacent, mm-hmm. that type of that type of civic organization. And she set the expectation that, you know, formal education was the most reliable tool to social upward mobility. And and like I said, my father, he grew up being able to enjoy some of the fruits of living in a neighborhood like, you know, Upshur Street. Now mm-hmm. we have an entirely different conversation about how that played into some of his identity struggles. Mm-hmm. So he, I'll end up bringing it back around, but I'll say this much. He had a lot of opportunities mm-hmm. that were in line with what was taught, you know, pursue education, find ways to be competitive, to be able to establish a career for yourself, et cetera. He had access to all of these things, mm-hmm. even in, as I said before, segregated, you know, DC, because again, you know, my grandmother and her husband were well integrated. They were part of that intelligentsia of the area. You know, they were both very fair skinned, even like they passed on convenience, like they had that level of interaction and access to networks. Despite all of that, my father rebelled. Mm-hmm. He said, well, you know, I don't like this world. I don't like kind of all of the what he would say, the bourgeois, you know, mm-hmm. kind of experience for Black folks at the time. So he kind of sought out opportunities to be militant and to kind of, in a very overt way, push back against some of that messaging and some of those values. So so my point is, it was a very interesting dynamic for me, because my grandmother, again, sought to provide me with these experiences, these acts, you know, these teachings, my father was very much aware of it, and he wanted it for me as well, but he didn't do it himself. So, you know, when we talk about first gen, it's complicated sometimes. So I was technically the first person in my family to earn a four-year degree, but I was not the first one to attend, you know, institutions of, you know, formal, you know, a learning and whatnot, or, you know, post-secondary, I'll say. So in that regard, you know, the expectation was, yes, you do this, but it was not necessarily the path that everybody walked in the family. So I was celebrated as the person who actually, like, oh, you finished, you actually followed through. But I was not, you know, the only person who valued it. I'll put it like that. You know, my mother's side of the family, she's from rural Tennessee, you know, small town outside of, you know, an hour or two outside of Memphis. And, you know, she came from a large family, had a, you know, 10 siblings total. You know, they had a very kind of agriculture and industry based kind of existence, you know, like everyone in the family goes to work in the factory, you know, the town factory, like that's what you do. So she was one of the few folks to leave Tennessee. So she came up to Washington, D.C. to work for the federal government, you know, who was recruiting at that time. And that's how she and my father connected. But, you know, as far as that side of the family, that the meshing wasn't the same. You know, if you could get, you know, a formal education and go to college, great. But it wasn't necessarily expectation. You know, the idea was that, you know, there are a lot of ways to make an honest living. And, you know, we kind of elevate all of those different options. And again, for a lot of my folks in Tennessee, it was like, again, kind of this notion that, you know, the pathway through formal education and college attendance and all of that leads to a kind of a way of life that a lot of folks down there are not comfortable with. You know, they weren't necessarily cool leaving home and going to a big city like Washington, D.C. You know, my mother, like I said, she was the exception in that sense. To this day, most of my family on that side are still there. So, you know, so there were a variety of different messages and kind of values that made the kind of the tapestry that I was raised in. But education was definitely valued. And, you know, it was something that I saw, you know, kind of twofold. There's a practical application, as I said, it's a good way for social upward mobility. But I also I love to learn. I love knowledge. One thing I did take from my father, like I said, he went a very militant route, but he instilled that in me too. He's like, you know, you get political, young brother, and you know, have knowledge yourself, and you engage in helping your community. And, you know, that stuck. So I guess I kind of morphed all of that stuff into one path, and, you know, the rest is history, so to speak.
Okay. You did talk to me a little bit about how you saw the University of Maryland in terms of wanting to enroll. But what year did you enroll?
Sure. So I graduated high school in 96. So I enrolled, you know, that following summer, or the fall of 96. And go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was going to ask, what high school did you attend?
Sure. Montgomery Blair High School in Silver Spring, Maryland.
And how did you come, I think we might have touched on this, but I'm going to formally ask, how did you come to choose your major?
Sure. No, we haven't talked about that, 'cause that's an interesting story. So, let's see. So I'll start with, I mentioned I went to Montgomery Blair High School. So that is an interesting, kind of crucible in and of itself, because, for folks who have grown up in this area, Montgomery Blair High School has a well-regarded reputation because of some of the kind of competitive application-based programs they have. It's a public school, but it has some very elite level, you know, niche programs that are, you know, not something to be proud of, but the reality is that they're kind of schools within a school. So you have the science, math, and computer science kind of STEM magnet program there, and you also have a communication arts program there, And those have both been in operation since the 80s. And were largely the result of, you know, trying to create incentives for white wealthier families to enroll. Because, you know, starting in the 70s, you saw, as in many communities across the country, you saw a very clear white flight from the, you know, Washington, D.C. suburbs, particularly following the riots, you know, and the uprisings after Dr. King's murder. So those programs were created to, you know, facilitate voluntary integration. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is, as I mentioned, I grew up in Tacoma Park, so I would have went to Blair anyway, just by virtue of it being my neighborhood, you know, zone school. However, I did, through a confluence of events, end up applying and being accepted to that STEM magnet program. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, my experience was interesting in that, you know, I went to school in the morning on the school bus with my folks, you know, from my neighborhood. But when I got to the building and I was sitting in class, I was actually, you know, side by side with students from all over the county, typically from much wealthier, much whiter areas of the county. And of course, at this point, there are large numbers of Asian Americans in those programs too. So anyway, the bottom line is, you know, when I graduated high school, I was on the STEM track. So I entered the University of Maryland as a mechanical engineering major. Because I thought, all right, you know, I was like, I'm going to use my love of science and, you know, get into engineering, because I do have an interest in just knowing how things work and operate. I like physics. So the idea was I will go to school, get a, you know, degree, establish a career and you know, this field, and with those resources and reinvest in my community. And, you know, try to do community work that way. So I got into, I would say, maybe the latter part of the first year, and I was like, oh, no. I said, this is not going to work. Because, again, you know, engineering, they don't tell you this in all the brochures, but engineering is like a lot of math. I'm thinking I'm going to be on, like, one of these shows building stuff at a little, you know, backyard materials and all of this. I'm like, nah, you basically on a computer. Numbers and equations. So anyway, so I got out of that quick. And thankfully, University of Maryland has a well-established African-American studies program or department now. And, you know, that was kind of my safety net. That became my home in what would have otherwise been a very wayward and, you know, alienating experience. So I'm glad that things worked out the way it did. So I ended up graduating with an African American studies degree, and you know, went into basically nonprofit work, you know, right out of school, eventually, you know, ending up in education. But yeah, so that's the circuitous story on what I ended up majoring in by the time I finished.
Okay. When you were a student, did you live on campus the full time you were there? What were your living arrangements?
Yeah. No. Well, technically, I graduated after 5 years. Particularly, like I said, when you change the major, that puts you back. So the first four were on campus, and then the last one I finished up commuting from my home in Tacoma Park. Indeed.
Did you live in the same residence hall, or do you remember the residence halls you lived in?
Yeah, actually. The first one I was in was Elkton. So that's, you know, one of the tall high rises on the north side of campus. And after a couple of years, I moved to, I want to say it was Carroll Hall. I believe that's one of them. And that's towards the south end of campus where the, you know, the South Campus Dining Hall is situated. And spent the last 2 years, I believe, in that hall. And that was a single. It was, you know, well sought after, whereas the, you know, my first experience was the more typical college experience. You know, you got the concrete, no AC, communal bathrooms. So yeah, you know, I at least got a chance to kind of have both ends of that experience.
Okay. So Definitely, I'm aware that you are very active on campus in terms of several things. But what I'm trying to get at first is, what was it like being a Black student on campus?
Such a complex question.
Right.
Well, I would say, generally speaking, I'll answer it in two dimensions. For me personally, and what my perception was for, again, just more conceptually, what was it like to be a Black student on campus? So conceptually, I'll start with that one first, kind of the broad, and then come back to the more personal. Like I was saying earlier, conceptually, the notion was, you know, University of Maryland is relatively diverse. We have many offices set up. We have the African-American Studies program, we have the Office of Multi-Student Ethnic, whatever it was called, OMSI at the time, Office for Student Multi-Ethnic something or other supports. I don't know if they still exist under that name or whatever, but the idea is you had an Embrugge Cultural Center. So you had the Black Student Union, a lot of the, you know, fraternities and sororities. So the notion was, as a Black student, you could come to Maryland and you could find your niche, because again, there were so many different opportunities and resources available, which again is not to dismiss, because a lot of institutions do not approach the level of networks and social supports that University of Maryland has. So I want to be clear about that. And the idea was, yeah, you know, there were enough Black people just by the numbers that there were enough of us there where you did not know all the Black people on campus. There's just too many of us. So you could actually find a little clique here or there. You know, you could find your social circle, and there was enough life happening that you did not feel like you were under a microscope per se, you know, because like I said, we were pretty well integrated into campus life and into the institutions. I would say that the biggest struggle then for, I think, a lot of Black folks who were attending was to not feel like we were tokenized. And that was, you know, University of Maryland has always had a very, but I would say, savvy and a well thought out kind of communications machine. Like, they're very good at kind of creating a profile of what their institution is, what kind of students they're looking for, all of their value as a public institution. You know, particularly in the 90s, they made a very deliberate push to kind of rebrand themselves. The leadership at the time said, we want to become one of the premier public universities in this country, you know, so that we want to be up there with the UCs and NYUs and what have you. So they invested money accordingly. And they, a lot of people don't realize this now, but they upped the admissions requirements steadily. A lot of folks in this area will tell you, so I wouldn't have got into Maryland today. Because again, there was a very deliberate push to do that. So my point is, to bring it around, is to say that a lot of folks that during that window of time felt like, you know, we want to not feel like we're just something to be used in the brochures or to be a value added in the midst of this broader kind of, you know, rebranding push. So I think that was the tension at the time. You know, yes, there's a lot of stuff here for us, and we feel like there's a place for us. But we also don't want to feel like we are, our value is transactional. I guess that's how I would put it. For me personally, you know, I was very excited to come to Maryland as a Black student, because I felt like, yeah, I did not want to go somewhere where I felt like I had to seek out people like me. And that was never an issue at Maryland. So I was very happy for that, appreciative. I felt like, again, you could go to Maryland and I could seek out different types of Black crowds. You know, we had the at the time, you know, slam poetry was getting big. So you could go find your poets. You can find your folks who are like hardcore culture. You know, you can find your conscious folks. You can go find the folks who just want to, you know what, I just want to party. You can find your folks who want to, like I said, who are the hardcore STEM. You know, I'm all about my professional ambitions. You could find different circles, and I liked that at the time, because again, part of, you know, that experience at that age is finding, you know, and formulating your identity. Who am I? What do I want to do? So there was a lot of opportunity to do that, to explore that in a healthy way. Now, of course, like I said, I imagine we'll get to, you know, my personal journey, as you mentioned, focused a lot on community work around campus. Mm-hmm. And reaching out to do service even beyond the campus community and in the surrounding areas and MPG. You know, that brought attention, not always the positive kind. So, you know, my personal journey was, you know, nurtured by these opportunities to engage and connect with people and to help and to serve. But, you know, I would be remiss to say that the repression, well, I won't say repression, but the reaction or the pushback or the attempts to intimidate and to try to limit some of the efforts of what we were doing was a big thing to have to process as well. You know, and me, I experienced it in very personal terms. It's one thing, like a lot of the debates happening now, you know, some 20 odd years later, it's distressing to see how similar some of the dialogue is. But for instance, we're talking about the debate over the specter of critical race theory and, mm-hmm. you know, whether or not we should be talking about race and making white folks feel bad about themselves and dealing with the notion that, you know, racism is truly systemic. It's embedded in institutions. You know, we're talking about all that stuff. People have been talking about, black folks have been talking about that for decades. This is the latest iteration of it. But again, the idea is, you know, when folks are showing up at these school board meetings and they're having their little meltdowns and they're getting arrested and everything, you know, it's still, the context is still one of, you know, macro level. You know, we're angry about, you know, these things happening out there or, you know, these things happening at the school board level. For me, it was folks coming for me personally. And that, like I said, just adds a different dimension to it. So so that was hard. And, you know, as looking back as an adult, you know, I have a different level of maturity now, obviously, and just life experience and wisdom to look back and say, you know, that stuff was traumatic. And it's mm-hmm. something to work through and process and, you know, put in its proper context so that we can still kind of look forward from a position of strength, but mm-hmm. still allow one to heal and for that restoration. And that's what allows us to continue to do this work. It's something that folks have had to deal with as long as we've been here. So, you know, I'm in that regard, my experience is not unique. It's part of a long tradition. We just wish less of us had to deal with it, you understand? So, so I would say if I was to kind of compare, like I said, what it was like to be a student conceptually, and like I said, versus what I had to deal with personally. Like I said, a lot of great things. There were obviously some negative challenges to work through, but I don't regret any of it. And, you know, I'm happy to have that as part of my walk through this space in life to inform what I do now. Because again, as these conversations are going through their cycles, because that's what history is, it's cycles. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to be able to offer support to students who feel like, yeah, you know, I feel like I'm being targeted. I'm now having to deal with, you know, how do I navigate active, you know, being active and advocating, knowing that there's going to be this blowback, you know, particularly in the age of, you know, we've had a very explicit racist occupying the office of the presidency. You know, it's not to say that we haven't had racist white men in there before, obviously, but this last one took the intensity and the brazenness to an entirely different level. So the fact that I can offer some support for students who are trying to make sense of that, to grow up, this is America, like this is what I'm growing up in, like how do I figure this out, that means that you know, those experiences weren't in vain. I can help provide some supports to folks who are now carrying that work even further. Okay. Indeed.
On campus, what was the first either civic or social organization that you joined? Because I'm trying to think of how to get at the meat of your engagement on campus in a way that makes sense to you.
Sure, sure. The first organization I would say I got involved in a meaningful way was the Society of Afro-American Studies. And that was it was kind of like a catch-all organization of sorts, meaning that at the time, it was comprised of students who, you know, were majors, who were part of the African-American Studies program or had interest in, pursuing a major. And so a lot of it was academic in the sense that we were meant to be a support system for students who were going through that experience. Mm-hmm. So that's how I kind of originally, found my way to it. I was like, wow, okay, there are Black people on campus who want to learn about Black folks and Black stuff and culture. And that's what they want to do full time. Like, this is awesome. I want to connect with some people like this. So that's what drew me originally. And then by virtue of being in and around students, who had some of these similar interests, we very soon pivoted to make our engagement more deliberate in terms of service, because the idea was, all right, well, we're learning about all these great things in class about, empowering communities and development and identity. And so how do we actually, how do we make this tangible for folks in a way that's going to advance the cause, advance these priorities that we learn about? So that's how we ended up kind of fashioning that organization into a service-based one. And that led to eventually the establishment of the Saturday Freedom Schools program, which we developed under the close support of Dr. Rhonda Williams, may she rest in peace, and also some well-placed grants that were awarded to us in those early years. And it was really great because we were able to blend, as I said, we were able to take what was going on in the classroom and bring it to these youngest, students. This was a Saturday mentoring program, tutoring and mentoring program that was done in partnership with Prince George's County Public Schools. We worked with the Greenbelt Middle School at the time. Mm-hmm. And basically, we reached out, we said, we have this mentoring and tutoring opportunity. We talked with the administration in the schools and said, if you have students who you feel like, they have wonderful potential, but they seem like they need a little support, a little guidance. And with that right intervention, we feel like they're really gonna kind of be at a tipping point and go off and conquer. Mm-hmm. And so they refer students to us who they felt kind of fit that mold. And we recruited, upwards of 20, 30 college volunteers on Saturday mornings. Instead of y'all sleeping in because you partied the night before, you getting up early and we coming in and we sitting down with these kids. Half of the morning was spent with traditional academic support. You've talked with, my wife Halima at this point, obviously. We did that together and we developed curriculum from scratch. So mm-hmm. she, came up with literally like math curricula that we were then delivering to these students, and then you had the college volunteers who were basically the tutors. They would help them, they'd bring in homework. We did the other part of the curricula was again, based in the African American studies mm-hmm. discipline. So we followed a culture tree model. We talked about five elements of culture and we did lectures, basically adapted for the appropriate, age level for middle school. But, brought in art, artistic expression. We brought in writing, brought in, again, just, oratory. So it was really remarkable, what we were able to do. To this day, I have one of the students who came through the program, he just got married and I still have loose contact with them. So it's crazy to see how folks have, gone on and kind of, like I said, walked their path, since we had these experiences. So like I said, that was kind of like the corner that became the cornerstone of the organization, that program. We also did teach-ins and other kind of like artistic based events around campus, but that really became what we were known for. And I think it's the greatest legacy of that group. You know, they were still running it right before COVID, you know, so mm-hmm. it's amazing to think that it is, you know, the department has taken it up and continue to recruit folks to run it. And, you know, it's been a really, really wonderful legacy. And so, you know, that stands at kind of like the core of a good part of my experience on campus, as far as, you know, advocacy and some of that service work. And of course, soon after that, you know, also got involved in the newspaper, the Black Explosion, which I imagine we'll also talk about. But I say, yeah, between those two, those were kind of the focuses, the folk I have, you know, my time there.
I want to back up a little bit to the idea for the Freedom School.
Sure.
Take us back there. And how did, because I'm told that you conceptualized it for the campus. So talk to me about what that was like.
Sure. We were, again, as an organization at the time, we were thinking about what are some ways that we can, again, do more effective outreach. Mm-hmm. We want to serve. We want to find ways to connect with other students and kind of share the love of knowledge of Black peoples, of African-American culture. So what's a good way to do this? So we, you know, we were just kind of kicking around ideas. And it was me. It was Dr. Williams. A couple of other, you know, the officer, the leaders of the group. And we just said, all right, well, you know, I've always been into the idea of mentoring, mm-hmm. you know, a very, you know, personal, a very genuine, a very earnest effort to help, you know, each one reach one, you know, he ain't my brother, he ain't heavy. So the idea was, all right, well, how can we find a way to systematize this? We want to teach folks, you know, I want to teach folks about the culture. We want to have opportunities to connect, but how do we come up with a organized way to do it? And that's where, you know, me and Dr. Williams in particular were sitting around one day, and you know, this idea, it just so happened that this grant opportunity also became available. I think it was with the Committee on Africa and the Americas, if I recall. I'd have to look that up, but yeah, I mean, that's documented as well. And the idea was they had this money to provide for campus, you know, efforts that were, you know, in the same kind of space of what we were kind of trying to conceptualize. Mm-hmm. So we sat down and said, all right, well, yeah, you know, we can do it on, we had to think about what's practical. So that's how we kind of arrived at doing something on Saturdays, because that's when students could have some availability to help. And we talked about, you know, let's try to reach out to some younger students, middle school seemed about the right age, because they're, let's just say they're impressionable. and they have a good, that they're starting to emerge when it comes to some of those questions about identity and how to conceptualize themselves. So we thought that would be a good sweet spot. And then we thought about, you know, the tradition again, if we go back to history, if we go back to precedent, where have we as Black people done things like this before? And that's where the notion of the Freedom Schools came up. And that's something that Dr. Williams in particular should articulate. She's like, yeah, you know, this would be like a Freedom School. You know, we're going to bring kids in and you're going to teach them about, again, politically empowering information, but also create some of the just basic skill-based kind of, you know, education. And we said, all right, and that's how, you know, that's how that name came to be, you know, Saturday Freedom Schools Program. And, you know, wrote it up, got it to the grant committee. They gave us an award. It was very small at the time. I think it was only maybe like $500, $750, something like that. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Williams said, of course, you know, we will, as a department, we'll underwrite you, you know, whatever other, you know, things that you need to kind of get things rolling, we got you. And, you know, we went forth and we put it together. That was, I want to say the grant was submitted in 98. We ran the first session in 99, I want to say spring 99. And, you know, we even did a fundraiser to try to, you know, get funds just to even, you know, we would feed the kids when they came to us. So we had to have money for that, which was hilarious. Because again, mind you, where are we college kids doing this? And to this day, like I said, Halima was there, you know, right there with me. So she still will clown me about this because, again, I guess I didn't talk about this in great detail when I was talking about how I was raised. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Gilman Park, working class, single parent household. You know, my father and mother split when I was, you know, in about fourth grade. So I grew up in a single parent family household headed by a black man, which is also mind blower for most people. Mm-hmm. Not the typical narrative. But anyway, the bottom line was, you know, money was not free flowing, you know, so mm-hmm. I had a very, you know, like I said, you know, we weren't destitute by any means, but, you know, I was not sheltered from financial struggle either. You know, I'll leave it at that. And the idea was, you know, I'm thinking about we feeding kids. I'm thinking about what I had to eat available on Saturday morning. I'm like, all right, we get him some cereal bars, some Tampico, whatever, and we're good. And, you know, Halima and a couple of other sisters like, oh, this is horrible. How could you? This is not breakfast. This is not appropriate. I'm like, I'm sorry. So anyway, like I said, just a cute anecdote to illustrate that we were figuring it out as we went. And it was very much an organic grassroots thing. And it was lovely because we were able to, like I said, pull, you know, college students who really were about sacrificing, you know, their time and energy to do something positive. So it was really positive group of folks who came together to do this. And we leaned on each other and came up, like I said, with something that really set a wonderful kind of legacy for the whole school, as far as I'm concerned. That's something that university should be proud of. The fact that they were able to provide that connection with the surrounding community, because there's not a lot of that happens. Not enough, I'll say. I wish the university had more engagement with Prince George's County Public Schools in particular, because a lot of, again, if you look at the numbers, a lot of students from Prince George's County Public Schools are not going to College Park. And there's no reason for that. There's a lot of work that could be done to establish a lot more accessibility for students who are of your community, where that university sits. Mm-hmm. And this was an effort that was doing some of that work. So I wish they would, you know, proliferate and multiply, amplify, do it more. Absolutely.
Okay. In terms of your engagement with the Black Explosion, how did that start?
Sure. So that was kind of a confluence of a couple of things. I have always liked prose and written word. Like I'm a book nerd. So as I said, you know, my father was very much in my ear when I was from a young age. You know, there are certain things that you just need to read, young brother. You know, you need mm-hmm. to read some speeches from Malcolm. You need to read the Black Panthers in a 10-point, you know, platform. You need to read Soul on Ice from Eldridge Cleaver. So, you know, I was from a young age, I was one of those kids who, you know, a lot of folks was out of the basketball court or whatever. I'm in school, you know, I'm at home reading books, because that's just, you know, that's what excited me at that age. So the idea is, you know, when I got to University of Maryland, I'm like, all right, cool. Again, we got more than one Black newspaper, because you had the Black Explosion, you had the Eclipse. I was affiliated with the NAACP, and the idea was like, this is just crazy. We got options to get, you know, news and information out through the power of written word to our community and everything. So the Black Explosion at the time, even back then, was kind of recognized as that was the more militant one. The NAACP and the Eclipse, that was, you know, they had some good stuff. But they weren't necessarily going to be quite as hard hitting as the Black Explosion was going to be. And the Black Explosion, like I said, even, you know, had the Black Liberation flag as the mass logo and everything. So I was like, all right, so maybe this is probably where I want to go, you know, what I'm going to rock with. So, you know, basically just got involved as a staff writer. It was an opening environment. So it wasn't a lot of rigmarole as far as being able to get the opportunity to write. Mm-hmm. It was, again, student run. It, you know, folks were figuring out as they went. And it was supported by the Nimbrew Cultural Center. So we had some staff there who served as advisors, for instance. But as far as, you know, getting that paper from conceptualization to writing to layout design to print, like that was students. Mm-hmm. And again, it was not structured like the Diamondback, where, you know, it's tied explicitly to the journalism program. So there mm-hmm. was some additional structure and institutionalization that happened with that model that was not present for us. So ours was a lot more self-made, self-taught. And the one thing that we were very proud of when we came in, because I was like, so I was a staff writer, but again, you know, it was FUBU. It was for us, by us, and, you know, FUBU is great, but sometimes FUBU doesn't always have quite the polish as some of our more mainstream institutions do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was apparent at the time. And me, you know, I take pride in my work and whatever I'm doing. So I started staff writing, and naturally we got to the point where I'm like, you know what? We could be doing more here, folks. You know what I'm saying? We could be doing big things. We should be on a level of the Diamondback. That's how I felt at the time. Mm-hmm. We should be, you know, doing, you know, analysis, doing, you know, access. We should be able to move through spaces just like the Diamondback. But we have a very clear agenda and a focus on what we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, at the time, like I said, the Diamondback was well affiliated with the journalism school there, which again, of course, is well renowned nationally. And the idea was, if you were a journalism student and you know, the university, you had to get clips from different papers around campus. And at the time, Black Explosion did not qualify. Which we had all kind of feelings about. At the same time, if I'm honest, our level of quality was not at the level of the Diamondback. So if you're really trying to say, all right, well, we want you to have a certain experience as far as standards and and journalistic convention and whatnot, it's one of those things where we know it's not just about that.
Right.
But that's it, you know, that's one of those low hanging fruit excuses that we can fix that, and then you ain't gonna have an excuse. So we jammed. So when it came time for them to look for another editor in chief, I guess at the time I would have got voluntold, as we would say now, because I really didn't want that level of work. But a lot of folks said, no, you would be great for this. Yeah, you gotta do it. So I said, all right, cool, let's roll. And like I said, within a year, we brought organization to it. Again, Halima was involved with that endeavor as well. You know, I've always enjoyed writing. So we just kind of brought to bear, you know, our own personal experiences as far as, you know, academically, what proper standards are. And we institutionalized that, created some systems. And by the time we got done that first year, yeah, Black Explosion was eligible for clips. For journalism class. I was like, you're damn right. And so my point is, I just tell that anecdote as a means to kind of paint a picture as to how we needed to kind of contend with some of those institutional barriers. Mm-hmm. But we were very deliberate about it. We did good work and covered meaningful issues and gave campus students something to be proud about, you know, and got more people involved. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, obviously that was the experience that most triggered the backlash that I talked about. You know, one of the things that we were clear about when I came on board, we're going to cover meaningful issues. We're going to cover stuff about race, about, you know, political disenfranchisement. We're going to talk about politics, and we're going to talk about the election. Like, we're going to do all these things. Like I said, we're going to do just on the level of what you would expect on these other mainstream, you know, publications, but we're going to tell it from a lens of the Black, you know, from the Black communities on campus. So we talked about hate crimes, and again, we ended up being part of the story, obviously, unfortunately, But at the time that this would have been, I want to say, yeah, 99, you know, there was a wave of hate crimes happening at universities across the country, just like there was a wave of church burnings. You know what I'm saying? Like, and we forget all these things. It's frustrating to me. But anyway, there was one incident at FAMU in particular. It was a pipe bombing that was found. And, it, you know, they caught the guy. It was found to be racially motivated and what have you. So we said, all right, we're putting this on front page and we're going to talk about why this is a problem and why we as a society need to be paying more attention to this. And that's really what kind of that got people's attention around campus. You know, we led with that. We had the issue cover was like a huge mushroom cloud. FAMU, it was striking and it caught people's attention. And it said, wow, all right, y'all really trying to talk about some real stuff, huh? Like, yeah, you know, that's why we're here. And but like I said, you know, it got attention. And, you know, when you're starting to move systems. And one thing I tell my students, you know, to this day, I said, and my colleagues, because I do a lot of, you know, in my role now as a diversity and inclusion, you know, specialist, a lot of what I do is, you know, coaching and professional, you know, development and helping teachers and educators know how to broach these subjects in the classroom context. And I tell them, I say, look, if folks aren't pushing back, you're not pushing hard enough. And that was just what we experienced. You know, we were pushing. We were pushing, you know, the status quo and what folks were used to out of, you know, what was the Black students' place on campus. Mm-hmm. And we started becoming agitative. We started becoming advocates. We started wanting to shape the conversation. And not everyone likes that because that, mm-hmm. Now we're talking about disrupting privilege and elevating voices that are used to being marginalized. And now you have to decenter yourself. You know, like I said, not everyone knows how to do that and be able to do that in a way that's healthy and positive. So soon after we started pushing out some of those issues, that's when the death threats came, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, though they were very personal, you know, these were arriving in my inbox, you know, like you got 48 hours, get off campus, we coming for you. And we're going to put your head on my dorm room wall. We're going to lynch you. You know, you go rob some old lady, go smoke crack. That's what y'all good for. This, that, and the third. And that was huge. You know, that was a whole thing in of itself to this day. And I wrote about it extensively at the time. I think the university missed some opportunities to deal with that in a way that was very clear about what was acceptable as part of being a member of the university community. And mm-hmm. with that, you can't just, you know, you can't simply make proclamations and sure accolades. You have to have some accountability, meaning that if you do not want to abide by the standards and the values that we have set forth to be a part of this community, then you don't belong here. And that's always been the rub, you know, not just for Maryland, but for, you know, public universities, private universities across the board. That's why, again, now we have this huge thing, you know, cancel culture is the worst thing ever. I'm like, most of the folks complaining about cancel culture are the ones who got privilege. Mm-hmm. They got something to lose. You know, now we have a situation where, you know, you can, like at the time, the debate, the way that it kind of shaped up was, all right, well, if we have folks who are expressing these views that are, you know, intimidating based on race or ethnicity, if they have personal websites, blogs, or what have you that have, you know, hate-filled imagery, the Confederate flag, they mm-hmm. have Nazi symbolism and whatnot, is that appropriate to be housed on university servers and supported by university dollars? And we had to have a debate at the time. Well, it's free speech. I'm like, no, it's not free speech. Again, we've evolved a little bit, like I said, a little 20 years later. But again, we had to have an entire national reckoning, apparently, for folks to be ready to have it. Well, maybe we shouldn't be flying the Confederate flag on state Capitol ground.
Or the state flag should not be the Confederate flag.
Exactly. All of a sudden, we were ready to have this conversation. But that was what it was that foolishness at the time. Like, nah, this is their personal beliefs. And, you know, yeah, we can't just ban that because that would be unconstitutional, this and that and third. And even then, as a college, I'm arguing, you know, there's a difference between hate speech and free speech. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a difference between harassment and you simply expressing an opinion. You know what I'm saying? There were structures even back then in the 90s for that. You know what I'm saying? So it was very frustrating at the time. And but we pushed. You know, I had conversations with the heads of the police department, conversations with the university's lead counsel about, you know, again, what was the right way to approach this and frame these issues. And, you know, and now we're at a place where then we wanted to argue that a student should be able to put all these hateful images up on their websites and, you know, you can skate. We're not going to do nothing to you. Now we're at a place where a person can, you know, make an, you know, a sideways comment on social media. Mm-hmm. And you don't even get accepted. You haven't even been accepted yet. And we send you packing. I'm like, wow, interesting how things can shift, you know. But yeah, it was formative, obviously. And it's something, again, that I've used as an experience to continue to educate, you know, even in the, you know, the public school setting. You know, we've had folks engage in, you know, young folks sometimes don't understand the impact mm-hmm. of their behavior. And that's another thing I love, that we've started to rethink how we articulate about these issues. You know, one thing that I talk about often that I think is great, that's been elevated as a principle in this anti-racism work, is it is always, always, always about impact over intent. And a lot of these students don't understand the impact of what they're doing. So I'll tell them, I say, look, you know, you threw around this word, you think it's a joke, it's edgy, it's subversive. I said, well, let me tell you how this really gets used and how it feels to be on the business end of it when folks really are serious. And that's where that's who you are emulating right now. And that changes the conversation in an immediate moment, you know what I'm saying? So it's like I said, it was a very interesting window of time to be on campus and to have the arguments and the debates that we did. And, you know, I wrote about it. I've written about a number of different things, but the one thing I've explained to folks at in the public school environment that was so tragic about how this went down, and it kind of framed it as far as what we were trying to say at the time. Again, if we don't hold people accountable and we don't make it clear that this behavior is intolerable, there's no place for it, and it is dangerous. If we don't make that clear, then you create a culture of permissibility where folks can engage in that behavior, engage in that kind of thinking, and you empower them to feel comfortable acting out on it. Mm-hmm. So here we are, you know, it's like 20 years later, roughly speaking, you have this young brother, you know, Richard Collins, yeah. He's on campus. He gets into I can't even say it, an argument. Mm-hmm. He shares words with this white kid who, again, acts out. We look into his background. He's got all of these, this ideology. He should have never been there. Mm-hmm. If he wasn't there, he'd be alive. And I'm not like, why? That's what we were trying to avoid decades ago when we were trying to argue about this stuff. That's exactly what we were trying to avoid. And Urbanski, you know, he just got sentenced in the last year or so, you know, and he now he's in jail. And he gonna be spending a lot of his years, you know, he's being held accountable, but it didn't have to go down like that. Like I said, we should be more deliberate and more proactive about making it clear that this dialogue, these ideologies, this kind of hate-based way of approaching one another, it's not acceptable. And like I said, at the public school level, that's kind of what drove me into being an educator. I'm like, at least we can start like building on the same kind of experiences with the Freedom Schools program. Mm-hmm. Let's start rooting this stuff out early and making it clear, like, nah, we got to deconstruct this. Yeah, you might have seen it on, you know, social media. You might have saw it on, you know, some joke that you got in an email, maybe even heard from one of your family members. Mm-hmm. But let's address that with their appropriate level of, you know, sincerity and seriousness it deserves, and deconstruct it, so we don't have these tragedies happening. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, it was a lot, just to say the least.
I have a background of doing too much on campus. That's what I say about it now, but just being involved in all the things, right?
Sure.
But it's interesting, and I'll bring this to kind of what I'm trying to get to, what I want to ask you.
Sure.
I can laugh about so much now, but at the time, I went to an institution where the campus police harassed Black students coming out of every party, right? Mm-hmm. And I originally went to college in 95. I graduated, went directly to college. So this spoken word piece you were talking about, I fully get that, right? But it was traumatic, some of the stuff we went through, not only trying to get the institution to see us as fully human, but trying to get people of color, not just Black people, but people of color to see that there was a reason we were pushing.
Right.
How did you keep your head about you during that time? You're actively being threatened. You're actively leading a student newspaper. You're actively an African-American studies student, right? Running freedom schools, things of that nature. How did you keep your head about you?
That is the question. I mean, I guess my best answer would be, it was relationships, you know, like, as I've talked here, like when I light up when I talk about like the volunteers we had, you know, mm-hmm. because I think about just the opportunity, the privilege, as I see it to this day, to connect with folks who are so positive and focused on trying to simply leave this place better than we found it. And I guess I find that incredibly hopeful and inspiring, because there's a lot of ugly stuff out here. We know this, you mm-hmm. know, and we confront it, and we challenge it, and we deconstruct it, and we rebuild it. You know, that's what we do. At the same time, to the spirit of your question, we gotta remember to celebrate too. We gotta remember to be nurtured and to be lifted up by all of the beauty that happens in spite of this ugliness. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's what made those years, you know, still something I look back on with a sense of serenity now, and a sense of again, like a feeling really, you know, grateful, mm-hmm. and very, you know, lucky, fortunate to be able to have connected with people to this day. Like, some of those relationships, I still have them, you know. Some of those folks I connected with, you know, they were at my wedding, you know, they've met my kids, you know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? And the idea is, you know, to know that there are other people out here in this world walking in this space with us, mm-hmm. who still choose to get up in the morning and choose to be better, choose to be them best selves, or at least continue to try. That's what tells me, like, wow, you know, that's what this living this life is about, you know, trying to surround yourself with folks who are really, again, they are finding a way to take the true beauty of human nature and make that the focus of how we, you know, interact and engage with one another. Because, you know, if we don't have that, then what's the point? I'm one of these folks who I'm very much against this notion that the ends justify the means. And I thought about this a lot. You know, this is another, and to the spirit of your question, you know, how do you keep your head about you? I was like, look, we spent so much time tearing this stuff down. If we did the same foolishness that we are mad about, what we going to do after it's gone? You basically showed how well you learned.
Gotta be impressive, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm like, nah. We got to remember to, again, elevate and center what's good and what's appropriate and, you know, aspirational, where we want to be at. You know what I'm saying? If we sacrifice that, and it was a waste of time. you're just playing a shell game at that point. So yeah, that kept me, that helped keep me grounded. It helped keep me appreciative, because like I said, I got great relationships. I met my life partner during that time, you know, obviously. So all of those things, you know, they can either make you or break you, like in like anything in life. And we chose, like, this is not gonna define us. This is not gonna snuff us out. This is not going to cause us to fold. We're gonna continue to do what we do. We're gonna continue to be inspired by the need to do this work. The fact that you're even doing this right now shows me why I need to keep going. And I'm gonna get the right people around me to keep me nurtured. And we're gonna keep each other balanced and not get overwhelmed and consumed with this stuff, and be sustainable about it. Because here I am, like I said, 20 plus years later, still doing this work. You know, I feel like that's a good outcome. I'm feeling good about that. So yeah, that's what kept me going. Having those relationships and hoping I could get to this point. I could look back on it, have some serenity about it, and be inspired to help the next wave of folk who are gonna continue to do this work. So absolutely.
So you're mentioning of keeping yourself nurtured, and essentially to me, it gets at Black joy.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there physical locations on campus where you felt welcome and nurtured and surrounded by people who had your best interests at heart? What were the comfortable places on campus, if you had any?
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I would not have survived without them. I'll say that. And, obviously the African American Studies Department, that was my home. And I felt like, you know, I mentioned Dr. Williams, you know, that she was family. You know, it hurt me to my heart when she passed. It was sudden. It was unexpected. And I felt like I lost like a mom, you know, because those were the kind of relationships that, you know, I was able to foster at the time. She might as well be a doctor. Val Skeeter, another luminary out of that department, you know, another surrogate mom, auntie, whatever you want to call it. You know, again, I've been to her house. She's met my kids. We've shared Christmas cards. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's family, you know? And, you know, she recently retired. She's earned it. She's been so much the heart of that department. And, you know, they made it very clear from the earliest days of me coming in there, you know, this is, we are here for you. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that not everything outside these walls is pretty and is easy to deal with. But when you come in here, like you said, you know, we got you. Mm-hmm. And we care, and we are going to put in the time and the energy to make sure that you feel like we see you. You know, and you're not alone. And like when I talked about going through my experience with the death threats, I'll never forget Dr. Williams. We rode up to that police department because, again, we had to fight the evening to get them to investigate the stuff. Because, again, this is mid-90s. This mm-hmm. is before social media.
Right.
A lot of folks not even really hip with the internet yet. They don't really know or understand what it is. You know, we were excited to have a personal email. Yeah. That was a big thing at the time. There was no Google. You were using Netscape, Jeeves, whatever.
Next Jeeves.
Exactly. So the point being that the way that the threats were done, whoever was doing them had some sophistication, mm-hmm. because you could not track these things. They sent them through an anonymous remailer. And it just so happens that my brother-in-law, you know, Omar Jenkins, you know, I'd known him before we all arrived at college, because again, I've known my wife since we was in middle school or whatever. So, you know, he ended up getting involved in the newspaper and did some things with us. Cause again, he saw that as a nice outlet for him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But again, he's like super, super hacker. You like these dudes, you ask him, what's your job? He can't tell you. It's too high. You know what I'm saying? But, so when we first got the stuff, we went to him. Because I said, you gonna know what to do. And sure enough, I'll never forget, he had in his little dorm room, He got like three computers. He got maps popping up. Little pins on, you know, tracing where it went, this point and this point and that point or whatever. And he was like, yeah, he's like, I can't track it past such and such a spot because then they would be able to track me. So this is where I could go. I was like, wow. But the point is, we're trying to tell the cops, you know, that this is what you're dealing with. They had no idea. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we even were trying to find out where there are possible connections that you could detect with students on campus. And that's where we got into this notion about what we did find students. We did. Mm-hmm. College students. We found other folks on campus who had these web pages or whatever, with, like I said, the discussion boards, the imagery. And we go to them and like, well, this is what we were able to find. We set up a meeting and, you know, it was me, Halima, and Dr. Williams. She rode with us. Like I said, that's real. She a real one. Because like I said, it's one thing to say, yeah, you know, we support you. But it's like, nah, when you go into the belly of the beast, I'm right there at the table with you. I'm like, wow. And to this day, I remember that. And we rode over our entourage. Omar was there, like I said, Halima, me, Dr. Williams. And they were just expecting just me to come, I guess. Because I said, well, yeah, we want to share with you what we're able to find. They thought I was just going to be this little old black boy, whatever. We'll roll him over. But we rolled up with our entourage. And all of a sudden, they're like, oh, hold on a minute. Then they go find like four or five other cops to sit at the table. They didn't say nothing the whole time. We got to have this image of force, you know what I'm saying? And, you know, like I said, but Dr. Williams, she said, I'm there with you. I'm with you. You know what I'm saying? Similar thing happened with later with the newspaper. We actually got into a back and forth with the university about what we could put in the paper. Because, you know, we got into this question of, well, you're sponsored by the school, so, you know, there is some level of influence that, you know, faculty can have on what you do or don't publish, this, that, and the third. And we went, looking at the bylaws, the charter of the paper, sat down with, like I was mentioning before, had a meeting with the head of the legal counsel. Ms. Val came with me to that meeting. She said, I'm with you at the table. You know what I'm saying? And so when people are willing to stand tall with you and put themselves in the line of fire, you know, there's nothing more, you know, there's nothing more compelling of a message for a young person in particular to see that and be like, wow, they're really willing to go all the way in with me. And when you have that, you just feel like, you know, I can do anything. You got folks with you. And so the Cultural Center, the Embrew Cultural Center, that's where, like I said, the newspaper was housed. Chris Page is another brother from back then. You know, we have many misadventures together. And, you know, he's another one of those, you know, staff who were just like, yo, you know, I'm here with you. You know, we do this together. He was very instrumental in helping us conceive the Saturday Freedom School stuff and how to go about putting together little lessons. You know, they put in that sweat equity, so to speak. You know, like I said, I'm not just going to talk about it, but I'm actually going to, like I said, I'm going to show up with you. And, you know, those spots on campus had those kind of people that I can name, you know, decades later and think of, like I said, with that sense of appreciation and pride. So, yeah, if it weren't for those spaces on campus, I wouldn't be able to speak with the level of serenity that I can now, because we all need that. We all need, like you said, the joy and the bonds and the solidarity to go along with all this other foolishness we got to deal with. So I'm very, very happy for those folks at the University of Maryland. Like I said, there's lots of some sideways stuff happened. But I got some really, like I said, quality A folks and relationships that came out of it too. So I can never go back and say, you know, oh, I regret it. And I wish it never happened, because now, like, I mean, look what I gained, you know what I mean? So yeah, definitely. I'm glad you asked. But yeah, I'll say NMBRU, African American Studies Department, those were my saving graces during my time there, for sure.
Could you kind of walk me through, to the point that you can remember, what it was like when you were leaving campus for the last time as a graduating senior. I'm aware that you still maintained some connection, but you knew you were about to graduate. Kind of what you remember of that experience?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, well, let me couch that. I loved it. I did. But it was also that I've talked about this a little bit with Halima and, you know, years following. That's where the trauma really started to show up for me anyway, meaning that, like, as I was graduating, I was almost like, am I really getting out? Is this really happening? I swear to goodness, for about 2-3 years after graduating, I would have these dreams, these nightmares of, like, you know, looking at my transcript and finding out, oh, actually, you short three credits. You actually didn't graduate.
Oh, no.
But my point is, the event of leaving was pivotal in a way emotionally that I couldn't appreciate at the time until years later. That's why I tell that little anecdote. But for me, graduating was like, it was an incredibly vindicating experience. And I'll tell you why, because again, I was involved in service, community organizing, advocacy. That was what I did because that's what I believed in. That's what I felt was the right thing to do. You know, you got plenty of folks at that age and throughout the remainder of their adult lives who are really about ambition, you know, accolades, celebration, whatnot. That was never my stick, you know what I mean? So I was never, like, I actually had folks come to me, like, there was a, I guess they still around, this is the Honor Society. And this is, it paints the picture of how I think about things to this day, because even Halima sometimes is like, wow, you really did that? Say, there's this honor society, and I forget the name. It was one, like, Greek letter honor societies on campus. And if you are a member, you can arrange to have your name engraved on that fountain outside McKeldin Hall, or the library, rather, McKeldin Library. And, you know, you got to be nominated for it or whatever. ODK. Haha. This is, I'm going to slide me the clip notes. She could not help but hear in her peripheral, she says. But anyway.
Can I say hello?
She says hello. Doctor says hello. So anyway, so ODK. Halima says hi back. So someone came to me. You know, like I said, these are in those final months leading up to graduation. They say, yo, they slide me this thing. It's like, yo, you should, you know, be part of the Science Society. I said, all right, fine, whatever. You know, show me the application form. I'll go through the motions. Then I get down to the jump. It's like, yeah, you got to pay $200-$300. I'm like, what? I'm a college student. How am I going to come out of pocket hundreds of dollars to have the award that you said you want to give me? Now, again, I get it. Like, that's just the way that a lot of these societies operate, or these organizations do business. I hear that. But I'm just saying it was so telling at in that moment, because it just was instinctive to me. I was like, of course I wouldn't do this. If you want to give me the award, give me the award. Anyway, but my point is, there are several other situations like that where folks were just throwing stuff at me. And I'm like, you was giving me all these problems while I was trying to do this work. I'm trying to, you know, talk about how we can change things on campus, how we can change processes and policies, and y'all didn't want to engage. But now on my way out, everybody want to say what awards they gave this kid, you know what I'm saying, this black activist or whatever. So it was a very interesting experience. And now here I am, I was doing all of this, you know, this struggle and pushing and fighting, and now that I'm on my way out, everybody want to basically hop on, as the kids would say, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to say, yeah, we had a part in that. So I thought it was hilarious. It was just very interesting to me. And part of one of the things that, one of the honors or whatever you want to call it, was I was named a senior marshal. And what that meant was, apparently you got to lead the procession of all of the graduates during the ceremony, the commencement ceremony. And like I said, I don't know what it is, but it was so symbolic to me. I was like, you try to, you know, make me vanish. You were, you know, because when the stuff was going on, I was a part of the talk too, from the police department. You know, do you want to, you know, lay low for a while? You want to move off? We got you, blah, blah, blah. I was like, hell no. And run me off campus. But again, I guess my point is, like I said, in that moment though, you know, here's a kid who, you know, who could have just washed out. Mm-hmm. Understandable reason, mind you, you know, could have just washed out, could have, you know, not made it to this point to not only, you know, scrape across the finish line, but, you know, play through the finish, you know what I'm saying? And so that experience just felt so good to me. I'm like, yeah, so yeah, no, I'm this little black boy, the dreads, leading all these other folks, symbolic and everything, but I'll take it, you know. And they actually, the university, the Washington Post, rather, actually ran a story about, it wasn't about the University of Maryland specifically, but it was about this broader notion of graduates and were they transitioning into careers, you know, sufficiently and whatnot. Anyway, bottom line is they got a picture of me right there with the story. You know, screaming or yelling or whatever as part of this graduation ceremony. I was like, that's the dot the I for you. I said, I'm good. So yeah, I mean, graduation, it basically symbolized liberation. You know, I made it out. And I did it on my terms. I did not fold. I did not play anyone's role. I did not have to compromise my values. And was able to help people along the way, make some great relationships, and, you know, did it with flourishing style. So yeah, that, and like I said, the trauma started sitting afterwards. But like I said, for that moment though, it was quite you know, it was quite amazing, to say the least. Euphoric.
So, you said you went into nonprofit work once you graduated.
Yeah.
So you kind of walked me through your trajectory after graduation.
Sure. So, well, the funny thing about that is when I was in, you know, when I was in my latter years at Maryland, I got into, you know, I changed the major, and really, to be honest with you, that was more of a, it was twofold again. It was, I just love knowledge. I was going to like, look, cause I was there on full scholarship too. I guess I haven't really talked about that. Mm-hmm. I was one of these Banneker Key scholars, which is interesting in of itself because, again, this is the mid-90s. You're in the midst of the, again, the national backlash against affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, there was this push against political correctness because at the time in the 90s, we called it multiculturalism. That was the way right. We framed it at the time. And then that, well, this is just PC. This is foolishness, blah, blah, blah. And with that, you had, like I said, the backlash against students being accepted to colleges, you know, affirmative action in the workplace, all these different things. So the idea was University of Maryland, as far as I'm concerned, again, they folded and scared of litigation. They had the Benjamin Banneker scholarship strictly for African-American students, incoming African-American students, full ride. And, you know, as cases were being brought across the country, it was clear that it was going to hit the Supreme Court. They said, all right, well, you know what? We're just going to combine these scholarship programs real quick. We're going to combine the Francis Key and the Benjamin Banneker because the Francis Key was not race-based. And they said, oh, you know, but we will still, you know, of course, make it a priority to make sure our community is inclusive as possible. We just can't do it. You know, we can't just target and set it aside for you, set aside programs, because that was, again, the language at the time. Anyway, so my point is I came in on that scholarship, and the idea was it wasn't tied to any particular, you know, course of study. So so my thing was, look, I'm getting paid to do nothing but learn. Mm-hmm. So hell yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and learn about some black people. Y'all paying for it. And I was still graduate. I have a degree by the time I'm done. Now again, I had no idea what career-wise I was gonna do. So that's what brings me to this, you know, the question about the trajectory of getting into the nonprofit sector, because the same time that we were doing, you know, the Freedom School stuff and getting into the more service oriented work. Also, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you saw the emergence of service learning as, again, this concept. And again, this is new to me. I was like, wow, so wait a minute. You're talking about I can do community service and it's like part of being in a class? So there's an office of service. Well, I forget what the name of the office was. It was Office of like Community Service and Campus Programs or something like that. And that was another one of the safe havens on campus for me, because they had their whole agenda was about getting kids or students rather into service and making that part of, you know, just the, it was a normative type of exercise. And again, it was that thinking that led to now an imperfect, mind you, implementation across public schools, you know, with the service learning hours, like that came out of the 90s, you know what I mean? Right. And the idea was, as I spent more time around that office and, you know, it was through them, I got involved in stuff like alternative spring break, where, you know, you go through Habitat Humanity over spring break, build houses, a lot of cool stuff I was able to do through them. But that's what, you know, gave me the notion that, wow, wait a minute. You're trying to tell me that there are organizations and their entire reason for operating is to do community service. Like, yeah, I can have a job. Now, again, I'm this little homie off of, you know, Lee Ave and Tacoma Park. I didn't know nothing about nonprofits. Like, that's a career field. And, you know, we Black folks, we're not really big on that. Wait a minute, you're going to go to school to go get paid peanuts to volunteer? Like, that's not the move for a lot of Black communities. But it was like my life's preserver, though, you know? So, it was in, like I said, those latter years that I got started to get familiar with that as an option. And being that we're right outside DC, you have one of the largest nonprofit communities in the country. So that's what led me to, you know, to pursue that upon graduating. I said, all right, well, let me see, you know, what's out here. My first connection was with the Higher Achievement Program. I worked for them for the first summer right coming out of school. And then, after the summer, I ended up working with College Summit. And, you know, that's where I met, again, these relationships. My first boss was Jamie Harrison, who's now head of the daggone DNC.
Oh.
And, you know, he's affable now. He's just as affable then. That's just the kind of guy he is. He's a great, great, great guy, great person. And, you know, College Summit was focused on increasing the college going rate among underrepresented minorities, et cetera. So, you know, I got into some of my first program development work there. Ended up using some of my skills from the Black Explosion, because those gave me my marketing skills. I could do layout design, work the computers and everything. Mm-hmm. And not to, again, you can, that was one of those situations where, yeah, working in a extracurricular activity actually helped give me my first job, real talk, you know? So, So did a college summit for a few years and, you know, ended up, ironically, my last job in the nonprofit sector before going into teaching was at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So here I am taking all the schooling from high school, being in that STEM program, because, again, I walked away from STEM, but ended up bringing it right back around, doing public engagement around science literacy. You know, so it was quite a remarkable little journey. I basically got to the point where I ended up doing a lot of management and supervising and whatnot, but I wasn't doing, again, the service. I got into the sector in the first place for us. So that's when I was like, all right, fine, I'll take the plunge. I'll go into the classroom. And again, Halima laughed at me because she said, since college days, she's like, you're going to be a teacher. I'm like, hell no. Why would I go back to the scene of the crime? But again, you know, again, age and maturity will do that for you, hindsight, perspective, blah, blah, blah. So ended up going into the resident teacher program through Prince George's County. It was a partnership between the county and Notre Dame University. And you know, it's basically alternative certification. You know, you go to classes in the evening and on the weekend while you're actually teaching in the classroom, and ended up teaching at Fairmont Heights High School in Capitol Heights, Maryland, over here in PG for several years. And then eventually got the nod from some colleagues in Montgomery County at Blair, said, you know, hey, you know, if you want to come back, I have a spot for you. So I said, all right, say less, it's done. So I was able to come back to my alma mater and literally give back, you know, at this place that helps set everything in motion. So it has been a wild ride, to say the least. But yeah, so that's kind of how I got into the nonprofit thing, because the service learning was something that was very exciting to me. And it was through those networks that I became aware of, like I said, nonprofit work as a career field, as an option, and loved it. And, you know, I try to now increase exposure among my students. Like, yeah, this is something you could do, you know, whatever skills you have, be it fundraising, publications, marketing, you know, any skill that you have, you can probably bring it to bear in the nonprofit sector. And that's another thing. It is maybe back like in the 80s and the 90s, the image of the nonprofit sector was like, you know, charities like churches and nuns and stuff. Like, nah, these places got millions. You can get paid quite nicely if you hang around and work yourself up the ladder, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, I just feel like for Black communities, we have very little awareness of this. It's like, it boggles me. And of course, that's another thing that came out in this racial reckoning. How do we look at philanthropy? Mm-hmm. And how we, again, even in the height of irony, an entire industry focused on supporting communities of color that has systemic racism that hurts people of color, particularly for Black women, you know what I'm saying? So it's just too much. But yes, anyway, so long story short, that's how I first got my feet wet doing the nonprofit stuff.
Okay. Did you attend graduate school between then and now? Well, you did with the alternate certification.
Yeah, well, exactly. So that was actually my second, engagement during graduate work. I have an MPA actually, public administration from George Mason. And that was done during my time at the American Association for Advancement of Science. So the idea was, for a short while there, I was on a trajectory to, like, you know, run my own nonprofit, kind of in the spirit of what we were doing with the, you know, the Freedom Schools. But again, similar to what happened with the engineering, like, as I got more networked and more aware of the business of running, you know, these non-public organizations, or not-for-profit, rather, organizations. The idea was, if you're at the top of these organizations, a lot of your time is spent fundraising. A lot of your time is spent, you know, going to functions and networking and whatnot. And I'm like, that's not what I want to do. So I queued myself up to go a particular direction, but learned that this wasn't really, again, going to be fulfilling. So you can probably peep that that's kind of been a theme for me. You know, I above all else, I want to be fulfilled, and I want to make sure that I'm doing things that, again, are going to keep me grounded. And that, for me, that's always been the service. So, you know, ain't no greater service than teaching cheering, particularly over the last year. 2 years.
What grade do you teach? What grades?
Yeah, no, I'm at this high school. I teach primarily 10th and 11th graders, primarily 10th and 11th. And he likes my position now. I came into teaching a dual certified in social studies content, secondary content, and special education. Mm-hmm. So I was, particularly when I was in Prince George's County at Fairmont Heights, I was special education case manager. I'm writing IEPs, you know, I am advocating for these students to make sure that they're getting the appropriate, modified and tailored educational experience. And we know disproportionately Black and brown kids are the ones ending up in those tracks. You know what I'm saying? So it was, I like the work. It was a lot. It was intense. because particularly Capitol Heights, you know, the area here in PG, like I said, it's this interesting story because you got a lot of Black wealth, but you still got some very stubborn pockets of poverty here. And, you know, Capitol Heights, it's had its struggles, you know, Suitland, Landover, like all this is basically, you know, where I live, you know, that's another thing. I like working where I live. So the idea is that, you know, I was doing social studies instruction when I came over to Montgomery Blair. Within a couple of years, they're like, yeah, we want you to run the department. I'm like, again, this is happening. I just want to teach. But the thing was funny about that is, again, this is my alma mater, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Blair is an interesting place, like I said, for a variety of reasons, but not only does it have a stellar reputation, it also has some very deep community ties. And that extends to the teaching staff. You have teaching staff at Blair who do their entire career, period, in that one building. So what that translates to is for me, Lil Rock, you know, he was in the, you know, going through these halls in the 90s. I come back mid-2000s, you know, even after that, I want to say I started teaching at Blair, you know, after 2010. And when I go to teach, I'm colleagues with some of my old teachers. They still there. So when they started asking about, you know, the old department chair was retiring or whatever, so they're going around trying to find out who's going to run the ship. They start coming to me in my ear. And I'm like, these are my old teachers now. That's a mind job for you. Your old teacher gonna be like, yeah, we think we'd be great for this. Mind you, I'm gonna be your supervisor. How you gonna supervise your old teacher? That's weird. Mm-hmm. But again, anyway, so we did that. It was a good run. Did that for a couple of years, and then you know, when the world fell down in 2020, you know, our principal, she said, look, you know, we need to reflect and think about what are we doing in this building, and how do we address some of these, you know, these fundamental issues. And she said, yo, Rock, I want you to serve in this role. Now, again, it didn't exist, but she basically was like, yeah, I want you to basically head up diversity, inclusion, and equity and stuff. I said, all right, cool. So I did some, again, my background in the service, nonprofit sector. I said, all right, well, I can find out, I'll find out for you what's typical in this field, in mm-hmm. this type of work. And we basically made the position, and, you know, I've been doing that, you know, for the last year and going into the second year here in the fall. So again, it's interesting cyclical kind of trajectory. And, you know, this is another kind of service, obviously, in this kind of a role, because I'm serving my colleagues, serving the students who feel like, you know, again, they haven't been able to show up as their full self, their true selves. So if we're serving in that capacity, again, there's no more meaningful work than that. So, you know, I'm happy for where I'm at. And like I said, would not be possible without my experiences with the African American Studies program, without that community service work. This is just, you know, how to, again, organize and advocate and things of that sort. So everything I've done, like I said, that started, you know, at least professionally at Maryland, has been brought to bear in some very meaningful ways that I'm proud of. So yep.
Okay. And sort of as a closing question, and sure. And I realize the more I do these interviews, I should probably tell people this question ahead of time, right? Like in the email. But is there anything you would like to share about your time at UMD as a message to current or future students, as advice or as like a parting message?
Sure. What I would say to, you know, current students at the university, I would say, do not underestimate yourself. You know, the work that you are doing right now, as you start to, again, formulate your identity and how you want to leave an impact on this world. You know, do not feel like the time and the energy that you're putting in right now to figure that out is somehow insignificant. Because there are things that you can do right now to work with the administration, to work with the leaders, to work with the departments, to work with, you know, each other, to help build that campus community. to be, again, to the best it possibly can, to really operate in a space where folks who follow you decades later will not have to go through the same challenges that you are now. And there are things that you can do as a student right now that will save some of that heartache, save some of that pain, save some of that trauma for folks coming after you. So don't feel like, again, the stuff that you're doing now is inconsequential. It's somehow a passing, you know, thought in the night. You know, there are things that you can do right now that can help create a legacy that will serve the folks coming after you. And so I would say, you know, use the time wisely, enjoy, but also don't be afraid to dig in, because the impact that you can have often exceeds anything that you can imagine. So stay inspired and, you know, enjoy the ride.
I think those are great parting words.
No doubt.
So I want to thank you again for taking the time to do this interview with me. And it was a joy hearing about your work and Halima's work and some of the things that I've been reading in the archival material. And these interviews really make this project so worth it. The effort it takes to put such a project together. But I'm going to go ahead and sign off now, unless you have any questions or anything.
No, I'm good. I would say, if there is any need for follow-up, please don't hesitate to reach out. And, I know that you've been doing your own research. If there's any primary documents that might be helpful that we might have, because we, I guess, call me, pack rat to a certain degree. But again, it has value for moments like this when we're trying to, you know, to convey culture and history to the folks coming after us. So my point is, I have a lot of that. I have old newspapers. I have old clips, all kind of stuff. So yeah, if you find that it would be helpful to follow up, say the word and we'll make time.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. I'm glad you're doing this. I was inspired to hear from you. So thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you later.
Sounds good. Take care.